Hey there, Lenny. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. It's great to be with you.
Welcome to On Location, Coast Side Edition, Sophia Lane. You know me.
Long time.
You know, long time. We've known each other for several years. In fact, on the way here today to the Napoleon Bay Brewery, I was thinking about when did we first meet? So I usually kind of these interviews have been a nice opportunity to reflect on that. And I remembered it was back several years ago when you were introducing to the Coast Side the College Futures program.
Yes.
Through CEF, and we were trying to really shift a lot of effort locally to try to help kids get to college that weren't necessarily getting to college previously. So was really fun and really indicative of your commitment to education and many equity issues throughout the years.
Still going.
Yeah, still going. And we are here today on this beautiful 75 degree, downright summery weather. So we are thankfully refreshed here with our Full Swing IPAs, which is my favorite here at the brewery. And I know you have a special connection to the brewery. It's been about 25 years, huh?
Exactly, 25 years.
Yeah. So tell us about your connection with the brewery.
So we started it 25 years ago. I was a home brewer before that. And the person who built my house, Mark Stegmaier, was also a big craft beer person. And when we were done with the house, he said, why don't we do something about craft beer? Because there wasn't anything on the coast. We decided, looked around for a while, and then we found this place. Mark did all the interior redesign and built the brewery, which we're looking at right now. And so, we were both had full-time jobs at the time. So
yeah.
We were smart enough to know that we don't know how to run one of these things. So
yeah.
We hired people who do. And 25 years later, we were the first brewery on the coast since Prohibition.
Wow.
And now
wow.
There's four within walking distance.
Wow.
Which is great.
So you kicked off a good trend.
Early into
thank
the
you. Side. Thank you. As a resident of the coast side. Thank you.
My pleasure. It's been a lot of fun.
Yeah. So what brought you here? You said you were working full time. How did you get to here?
So I was working at McKinsey, the management consulting firm in San Francisco, but I was traveling a lot. And when my older daughter was born, looking for a place where we'd want to put down roots and stay.
Yeah.
And Christine and I looked around and she really fell in love with the coast.
Yeah.
I used to come fishing here when I was a kid. There's
yeah.
a big, I'm half Portuguese and there's a big Portuguese Azorean community here as
yeah.
well. And we just fell in love with it and bought a place that we could walk our daughter to kindergarten at
yeah.
Fairlawn View.
Yeah.
And
I'm very familiar.
Literally this
yeah.
week or this month, our younger daughter took her younger daughter to Fairlawn View at the same
Aww.
Place that she went to 30 years ago.
Wow, that had to be so sweet for her.
It was.
Yeah.
It's all remodeled. Looks great.
Yeah, yeah.
She loves it. She loves her teacher. It's
yeah.
very fun.
Yeah, that's very awesome. That's very awesome. And you've been involved. I know so many people know you through so many different routes. You were at McKinsey for a long time. But you weren't just in that sector. You've always been involved with nonprofits and education. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah. So, I mean, my professional life was almost 30 years at McKinsey as a management consultant, a combination of San Francisco, New York, and Washington, D.C. I spent most of that doing private sector work. I spent a fair amount of time doing research and overseeing all of their academic relationships, and then helped chair them create their nonprofit practice. And then I was the person who built their government practice for state and local government. So
yeah.
I was out and doing that as part of my job, but
yeah.
I also spent a lot of time And that's what I'm doing full time now is serving on nonprofit boards and helping public causes that I've mostly been involved in, either education or economic development related issues.
Yeah. Yeah. Which of course are very tied together with each other, right?
Exactly.
It's hard to have economic development if you don't have education, and education in a way that is equitable to including populations that historically maybe haven't been.
No doubt.
Served as well.
You know, by far in an economy like the United States and certainly in California and the coast, the single biggest, most important economic development engine is a high quality group of people who are living there and working. So it's
yeah.
focusing on education all the way from pre-K through post-secondary. If in today's workforce and work environment, that's how you compete. you know, the coast, California, even the United States, not going to compete on being the lowest cost. It has to have the the best workers on that. Best opportunity.
The quality of the product, right?
Exactly.
The quality of the work product. And so I guess it makes sense because with your work at McKinsey and, you know, how that dovetailed into your work with nonprofits and educational institutions. I know you were at Stanford teaching for a number of years as well. And you were the governor, right, of California for a bit too, doing economic development. How was that transition going from nonprofit and from McKinsey to government?
Sure. So when I retired 10 years ago, I took a year off, and Christina and I traveled around, watched the Giants win the World Series, which was great. and I concluded I didn't want to do anything full time, and so I've been doing basically what I'm doing now in nonprofit boards and a little bit of investing in business related things. And I've been involved in Democratic politics and political activity in the Bay Area in California for a while. I first met the governor when he was a supervisor in the city of San Francisco.
Wow, that was a while ago,
Yes, and to work with him. He was on the Bay Area Council's Economic Institute board with me. And then when he was lieutenant governor, I wrote his economic development policy and his higher ed policy. And then I told him if he got elected, I'd help him. And he said, great. And what I meant was part-time from the outside. And so I did a little bit of that.
Words matter, Lenny, right? Words matter. You need to put some SMART goals around that.
I really was not intending to. And then he kind of insisted that I come in full-time, which I did for a little bit as his economic and business advisor. And then in my first meeting, with the cabinet, he turns to the group and says, I figured out who's going to be the chair of high-speed rail. And he points to me, and I thought he was joking. And I walked out, and his chief of staff said, he's not joking. He's going to announce it tomorrow at the State of the States. You have 24 hours to decide.
Oh, wow.
So I'm like, I can't say no. So I ended up agreeing to do that too. But yes, no, that was a total blast. And I got to be on the inside of and these issues of economic development and connection to workforce and regional economic development, where I spent most of my time.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And of course, right now, politics are hard to get away from in terms of, you know, just the sheer magnitude of what's happening right now in our country and the really important pivotal role that California is rising up to play, which in most ways it already always was, because being the fourth largest economy in the world, fourth, with the U.S. being first, and if you split out California, of course, it's fourth, it was always a major player in the political and economic landscape of our country. But of course, now with the tone of politics and the nature of what is happening, it's getting more interesting, isn't it?
Yeah. You know, and in some ways, a lot of the stuff that we were working on then are not really partisan issues. Kind of creating good jobs, creating high quality education opportunities are not, it's the same objective. People go at it in different ways. But California, as you said, is so big, it's different by what part of the state you're talking about.
Yeah.
We are, as you said, the fourth largest economy, the largest manufacturing economy in the United States, the largest ag business. We create more new businesses. Number one for tech and VC investments, largest number of Fortune 500 companies, number one public education system, and by the way, more wineries and breweries than any other state.
Well, I think that might be the first one to put on the list.
But, you know, California has always played an outside role since World War II in particular on the economic and political stage.
Yeah.
And, you know, the largest number of members of the House, all those kinds of things. And so, particularly when the party in power in Washington and the president is pursuing an agenda that is not in the interests of Californians, we have an obligation to step up and assert that relative strength in a way that is good for California, but frankly, it's good for the direction that we think the country ought to go.
Yeah.
And we're not going to back off on our environmental and climate goals.
Nope.
We're not going to back off on a view about equal opportunity for everyone, regardless of your race, your gender, your sexual orientation, religious background, anything else.
Yeah.
And, you know, we have to stand up for those values
and
use the levers that we have to try and make a difference in that. It's hard when you've got president and a party that has both houses, the Senate and the House, and effectively controls the Supreme Court. So you got to be creative about how you do it.
You got to get creative. Yeah. And I think a lot of people are really actually pleased to see the creativity that's coming out, to deal with what one might call the new world order, where the rules of the game have changed. And so, it makes sense that maybe things are a little bit different. And I think one thing that a lot of people, myself included, appreciate about you is California, as you mentioned, is a diverse state, and you don't come from the coast, right? You come from a fairly inland place. So how do you feel like growing up where you did influences kind of your beliefs and how you approach making these changes or helping to make this progress for not only our state, but our whole country?
So as you said, I grew up in Central California in Turlock. We still have a family farm there. In fact, I was there today, not on the farm, but in the Central Valley. And it was one of the things that when I was governor asked me to join, I wrote down the things I wanted to work on.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them was what became now today is California Jobs First. We've called it the original Elements or Regions Rise Together, which was we live in, if it were an independent country, the richest country in the world in Silicon Valley.
Yeah.
If 100 miles away where I grew up, if it were an independent state, we'd be the poorest state in the country.
Wow.
And that's just not acceptable.
No.
And so trying to bridge those things in a way that we can have all the benefits of that diversity and have the opportunity and wealth and opportunities for our children to be the same across the state is hard to do, but a really important aspiration for California. And, if we want to be a model for the rest of the country, we have to do that here as well.
Yep. You're right. And it's interesting because that theme of adjacent communities living with such stark differences came up recently when I was speaking with Antonio Lopez, who, as you know, was the San Mateo County Poet Laureate, who grew up in East Palo Alto, literally next door to Palo Alto, Menlo Park, which, are in Atherton in that area as well, which are among the highest wealth zip codes in the country. And it was, he kind of had the same perspective in terms of being passionate about bridging that divide, that economic divide, that even in a state like California that that strives for progressive values and goals is still the reality that we face, even in our community here on the coastside, right? We have multi-million dollar homes adjacent to farm worker housing or even, scant apartments that are challenging for families.
And, he lives in day to day where it's literally across the highway or across the railroad tracks, as they say.
Literal tracks.
And, in the coast, there's a little bit of geographic separation, but it's a lot of intertwined, which is part of why we love it here.
Yeah.
It's not like a walled off community.
Right, right.
If you're engaged in the coast, you want to be engaged in the richness and fullness of that community.
Yeah.
And both benefit from all the things that are terrific here, but also create opportunities for everyone who lives here or grows up here.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So going back to what you were starting to say about, what we're starting to talk about in terms of, the situation right now that we find ourselves in, and, we talked about the game has changed, right? It's not what we would have thought, it's not the way governance happened even 5 years ago, never mind 10 or 15 or 20 or 40, because many argue that a lot of these changes really started to come into play in the 80s, initially with, things like trickle-down economic theories and such that started to influence the way we thought about economic policy, social policy, justice, immigration policy, things like that. So now we find ourselves in a situation, like you said, where we have a huge imbalance of power, where there's a relative minority, perhaps, that is taking our country in a particular direction that, by all polls, is probably not where most people want us to go.
I mean, the economic forces are broader than just the U.S. with globalization, technology, and other things, deregulation. But the political landscape has changed dramatically in the United States. And I remember going to President Obama's inauguration, and afterwards, or at dinner in a nice hotel, And in a private room next to us, and you could see glass enclosed, was Newt Gingrich holed up with the Republican House leadership, basically communicating to them how to do what he did to Clinton to make sure that Obama couldn't get anything done.
Oh, my God.
And, yeah, you know, that was the good old times.
Yeah.
Now we're at a period where it's not just, you know, traditional power play with it between two parties in Washington. It's we are at real risk and may already be on the path to a kleptocracy and a dictator.
Yeah.
And it's not normal times. And so that really does require a different level of engagement in a way which is not I'm Democrat or Republican. It's I like democracy or I don't.
Yeah.
And so really do. And California is and will play a really leading role in that around what does that mean?
Yeah.
You can't, in a normal environment, you'd say, well, let's just use all the levers that we have and, you know, the courts will constrain or, you know, we'll worry about the budgets. But that's not what he's doing.
Yeah.
He took Project 2025 and implemented half of it in 6 months. What do you think the next 2 and 3.5 years are going to be like?
Yeah.
So this is like urgent times for involvement and participation and pushback in a way that we use all the levers that we can.
Yep. And the state of California has taken some steps towards using a lever that probably we wouldn't have thought would be something we'd need to use, even maybe a year ago, even maybe 6 months ago, the beauty being by the airport.
I mean, I like when airplanes come over because it means it's nice.
It means they can see.
Exactly.
We're making some vitamin D as well here on the patio. Yeah, so like, you know, it's something kind of new that's come up now in terms of redistricting and gerrymandering. You know, tell us about that.
Sure. And there's a little bit of history that's important here. California actually led the way for independent redistricting almost 20 years ago in 2008 and 2010 with citizen-led initiatives to first do an independent redistricting commission for offices in Sacramento, and then 2 years later, it was passed for legislators in Congress. And so we have kind of what's generally perceived as the gold standard for how you draw districts in a way they're as representative as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And so many of us, I was involved in that, continue to believe that is one of the important things that we need to do is to extend that kind of thinking across the country and make sure we have equal and fair representation for everyone. The problem is that most of that has been done in Democratic states.
Yeah.
And you have Republicans in places most aggressively now, driven by the president in Texas, to basically say, you owe me 5 more seats. And
right.
The same kind of language that he used to tell Georgia that you owe me 12,000 more votes.
Right.
It's like, you owe me 5 more seats. And so in normal times, you'd say, no, we're going to stand up and say, we're going to keep doing things the way we do.
Right.
And that, you know, if they take 5 seats, that's okay.
Yeah.
That's not what's going to happen.
Yeah.
They're going to do what they're doing it in Missouri, Indiana. They're going to try Florida. Ohio needs to redistrict. Utah, fortunately, went in the other direction because of some court cases, but we'll see.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you can't just stand back and say, no, go ahead and do whatever you want, steal another election.
Right, right. I mean, in a way, it's kind of a sort of a form of political bullying, right? Or, I mean, I don't know if it's euphemistic to use the word mob boss, but like in terms of really having that threat of getting pummeled and pummeled and pummeled despite what the rules of the game are, right? If you're playing a football game, there's rules or people get hurt. And if one side is playing by the rules in this football game and the other side is not playing those rules in this football game, then why should one die and the other, you know, just wins?
No, you don't say, we set up this game and in the middle of it, you move the 20-yard line.
Yeah.
So you can't
do that. Exactly.
And, you know, there's some analogy to, you want to say principled on, we believe that's not the right answer. We need to fix this in a different, longer term. Make sure the rules are right and are fair and enforced for everyone. But in the meantime, that doesn't mean you unilaterally disarm or, you know, wave your principled flag as you block over the cliff with everyone else. You have to fight back. And there's actually very good political moral philosophy going back to St. Augustine about this on the principles for just war.
Yeah.
It's, you know, when you're about to get pummeled,
yeah,
sometimes no matter how anti-war you are, you have to fight back.
Yeah.
And this isn't a literal war, obviously, but it is a, you know, a battle for the future of democracy.
Yeah.
And at some point you have to say, this is a better option than having the country destroyed.
Yeah.
And so that's why many of us, including me, have come out very strongly on the side of, we can't just let them walk all over us. We believe, by the way, in the Prop 50, on the proposition that's on the ballot in another month and a half, says we are going to reaffirm voters, reaffirm independent redistricting the next time that's relevant, which is the next time there's a census, which isn't until 2031 election. The census isn't 30, it'll be 31 and 32. Yeah. And that we want that extended nationally, which is what would have happened if the Senate had passed what the House passed under President Biden. And so it's saying that's what we want. But in the meantime, if Texas takes five seats, we're going to retaliate in kind at that same scale, temporarily, in a way that is transparent and voters approve and respects minorities' rights in the drawing of those districts, none of which Texas did. It was not transparent. Voters had no say. It was no response to anything. They were just stepping way ahead.
Yeah.
And they're trampling on civil rights in the process. And so it's a different kind of response. It's not tit for tat. It's a principled response to an unprincipled for by Texas.
It's almost, it's not about throwing an offensive shot at another airplane. It's really, it really is blue sky, so it's some puffy white clouds. But it's not, like you said, it's not a tit for tat move of like just throwing punches for no, just for offensive reasons. But it's like at some point you have to have a defensive move when someone is, taking shots at you offensively.
And, you know this, I'm on the board of Common Cause. And I've been very involved
with them. I was going to ask you about that.
They think about this, and they have been and were, among with a couple of others, including League of Women Voters, the primary advocates for independent redistricting, and remain so. But they went through a process, and I was deeply involved with it, to think about how do we respond and what's the principles that you want to act under conditions like this. So established a set of fairness principles, which are very analogous to what I said around just war principles, that said, if you adhere to these principles and you're responding to something, we will not oppose it. And if you stack those up, California versus Texas, Texas violates every one of them, and California meets them. And therefore, Common Cause and what League of Women Voters followed, not dissimilarly, say, can aggressively oppose Texas, and we're going to stay neutral in California.
No, that, of course, that makes a lot of sense. I think if we, it's easy sometimes, I think, to take the, to see, to look at the trees in the forest and think, I don't like that tree, Like, I wouldn't want that tree in my backyard, But it's about the forest right now and just having, as you said, that, protection at a grander scale, not only for our state. This is more of a move.
This wouldn't have been necessary if the Supreme Court had enabled a set of things to occur by some decisions around saying that partisan redistricting was not a judicial matter. Therefore, they don't intervene. And secondly, this administration in particular is not enforcing the Voting Rights Act. And so Texas can get away with what they're doing because the Supreme Court, most of which were Trump appointees on the margin, enabled this to occur by allowing partisan gerrymandering and not enforcing the Voting Rights Act. That's how Texas can do what they're doing. If those were not in play, this wouldn't have happened.
The 20-year line was moved.
Deliberately.
Deliberately.
And don't then be clear, they're going to move it all the way to the 50-year line.
Well, I think that's something sometimes people don't realize about kind of that bullying culture or that mob boss culture or whatever culture, whatever we want to call this culture right now, of continuing to push the push the limits and not seeing the situation as a compromise to say, hey, we'll take this and then you'll get the next time, or we'll stop there. It's kind of a path towards a Project 2025.
I mean, they laid it all out in writing. Shouldn't be a surprise.
And
so, it's not just partisan gerrymandering and things in the election process. It's, what's going on by trampling on civil rights with ICE, by sending out the National Guard in LA and yeah. Washington, D.C., and looks like Chicago next. Those are not normal things.
Not normal things at all. We saw the Supreme Court's decision today, just today, earlier today, regarding that case in LA, where it's now free and clear to go profile people. And even if it's a temporary detainment, it's still detainment. And we don't know what's happening behind those scenes.
All marks along the march of authoritarianism.
Yeah. Yep. So I know like a lot of people, and I hear this from a lot of people, and I imagine you do too, these days are feeling like, oh my God, what do I do? Yeah. Like I'm just a mom, or I'm just a whatever, like, you know, I'm just a worker here. I don't have real power. Right. But it seems to me like this opportunity around Prop 50 might actually present a very tangible opportunity for people to jump in and help. What can people do?
Well, first of all, the sense of there's nothing I can do. It's chaos. This is inevitable. And I'm frustrated and scared is what they're trying to do.
Yeah.
And so you can't let that happen.
Yeah.
You know, you can't give up hope. You can't give up a sense that this is not inevitable.
Yeah.
And you have to think about what are the steps that we can do along the way that ought to happen across the country, and what can you do to help personally? And so the first thing is turn off your social media feeds, except for a little bit of the time you want to do it.
Yeah.
And don't get caught up in that, because that's the echo chamber of people yelling at each other. Yeah. Same thing mostly for cable news. And then it's finding things that get you positive sense of opportunity and that you are actually making a difference. Most of that for most people is in your community.
Yeah.
And so don't feel like you have to solve the grand problem.
Yeah.
Say, how can I do something that helps my neighbors?
Yeah.
How can I do something that helps get more people out to vote? How can I actually make sure that all of my friends are registered and do turn out to vote?
Yeah.
If you have the ability to volunteer time to do things, or if you have the ability to donate to causes like that you care about,
yeah,
that's even better. But it doesn't have to be that. It's, you know, stay engaged. And starting to see with Prop 50, especially in California, it's now become a national issue. It's a sense of this isn't inevitable.
Yeah.
And we're going to fight back.
Yep.
And we're going to win this.
Yep.
Then, you know, this is a really important step to ensure, as you said, that a mob boss authoritarian doesn't just run over everybody, that there's some pushback. It will be essential to ensure there's a fair fight for the House of Representatives in 2026.
Yeah.
Democrats win 2026. That totally changes the dynamic in Congress and puts at least an element of it, some brakes on what we can do. And then we're going to have to deal with the presidential election in 4 years. And, but, you know, if we don't win 2026, we may not get to 2030. That's why this is so important.
Yeah, that makes it so, so difficult, right? It's kind of just thinking not existentially about the longer term, but just thinking about what is our midterm goal right now. And that really is, you know, the House in 2026. So we get back to what I think we can, you know, most people would acknowledge that our founders had envisioned for our countries, having a three-part federal government with checks and balances for each. And so now when all three are kind of, you know, working in cahoots.
I mean, it's okay if they're all the same party for a while. It's not okay when the executive branch says, I don't care about your budgetary authority.
Yeah.
I'm just going to take the money and do what I want with it.
Yeah.
Or they end up having courts that let them do whatever they want.
Yeah.
And more disturbingly, push the limits on everything to say the only way you're going to stop me is by taking me to court.
Yeah.
That's not the way you govern in any principled way. That's what strongmen do.
So what people can do then, if I'm hearing correctly from your thoughts in the short term, is have hope. Don't. What is the expression? Don't comply before you need to, kind of thing.
Yeah.
The compliance in advance is like not a good idea. So have hope, because that's part of the strategy is to instill fear, right? Like some of these tactics are theater.
It's a explicit statement, particularly with government employees. We want to instill a sense of fear and chaos so that they can't get anything done.
And then just be active and engaged in your own community, because sometimes that's going to have a huge impact. And then where you can donate or volunteer for organizations like Common Cause or campaigns like Prop 50, then those are things that, you know, usually we could all do something. It just maybe takes a little bit of that first part of the recipe, I think, like you said, is the most important, to feel like I can and I should and I must do something because I have kids or I have grandkids that I care about that I want to see grow up somewhere where they will have some of the, you know, at least all of the rights that we've had growing up.
Yeah. And I will double click on the importance of Prop 50. Mm. It's really the only thing that's on the ballot in November of this year that's relevant for California that you can do something about.
Yep.
And if people are informed and show up, it will win.
Yep.
If they feel that it doesn't matter or, you know, I can't make a difference and they don't vote, it's not guaranteed to win.
And the one thing I know we were chit-chatting earlier about was the unique thing about a proposition that sometimes people forget is it doesn't matter where in the state you live, right? Because I know sometimes people think, oh, I live in a very blue area. I'm not going to vote because it's going to go blue. You know, my area is going to go blue anyway. And like, really, this doesn't matter because a vote in Half Moon Bay, you know, is the same as a vote, you know, anywhere else in the state. So whatever turnout we can get across the board, regardless of where it's from, it matters.
It does. And it matters on a national level.
Yeah.
So this is, I mean, it's winning the battle in California on behalf of the country.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's using our federalist prerogative to ensure Californians have a say in these matters, as opposed to saying Texas is going to redistrict. And then, as you said, California votes won't matter.
Yeah.
No, that's not true. They
That's not true. Yeah, yeah, they do. And if people want to learn more, I know Common Cause has a lot of really good information on their website. I know you've written a few really good pieces on this. Was it in Project Syndicate?
Yes.
I'll post those links as well. I'll
but,
find
you know,
those.
For a nonpartisan kind of just the facts view about what Prop 50 is, either Common Cause or the League of Women Voters on their websites will have really good information about what it is.
Fantastic.
And then I would encourage people, if they're really interested in it, to look at the fairness principles that I described that Common Cause did to say, why is Texas different than California? And then if you believe that you need explanation about why it's important, I've written some things and there are others who are advocates for it. Common Cause is not advocating for Prop 50. They're staying neutral. I'm personally advocating for it because I think it's important for the country.
That makes sense. All right. Well, thank you so much, Lenny. This has been
thank
great.
You,
always great to have a beer.
Cheers.
A final cheers. Cheers. Thank you so
thank
much.
You.
Enjoy the sunshine that we have today. The scalding 75 degree coastside weather in September. I know it's like, ooh, well, I'm sure all the kids that grow up, your mind included, generally these days are like boiling.
No, we need air conditioning.
I don't know, air conditioning. No, it's called the ocean.
Yeah, exactly.
That's our air conditioning.
Enjoy.
Well, thank you so much. Right. And we'll have a beer soon.
Okay. Thank you.
On Location Coastside Edition with Sophia Lane is produced by Bright Now Media. Stay tuned for our next episode coming soon, and thanks for listening.